Today is Wednesday, October 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a disaster of monumental proportions unfolding on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi.
The people are very terrified, and our Red Cross volunteers are having a really difficult time accessing a lot of the most affected areas. It's a race against time to still help survivors.
President Trump warns that allegations against his Supreme Court nominee are frightening to young men.
So when you can be guilty of something that you may not be guilty of.
First Lady Melania Trump makes her first stop on a four-nation trip to Africa, and the Nobel Prize in Physics is announced. Well, we begin today with desperation, visible everywhere in areas heavily damaged by an earthquake and tsunami 4 days after the disaster devastated parts of Indonesia's central Sulawesi Island. The death toll now more than 1,200, and it's feared that scores of bodies could still be buried under quicksand-like mud. Tens of thousands have been displaced, hospitals are overwhelmed, and people are desperate for food. More than 25 countries have offered assistance. Joining us now to talk more about this, Laura Ngo-Fontaine, Senior Communications Officer with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. I know your organization is on the ground and actively involved in assisting with this disaster relief. What are your people on the ground seeing, and what are they saying?
Well, Lori, the full extent of the disaster is still emerging, but we are seeing a large population of people who are in shock, are still suffering a lot of fear. They're lacking shelter and water and food and medical assistance. The people are very terrified, and our Red Cross volunteers are having a really difficult time accessing a lot of the most affected areas. It's a race against time to still help survivors. Earlier this morning, our Red Cross teams arrived in Sigi, and the scene there was tragic. I think you've probably heard this, but they found 34 children who had died while they were attending Bible camp when the disaster struck. Mm. And so it's very, very difficult to reach these areas, and there's a lot of destruction and damage.
Are they describing what it looks like there on the ground? Is there anything left? It sounds like everything's just been flattened.
There's a lot of mud and rubble. 161,000 people have been displaced, with more than 6,000 homes destroyed. Some areas are just impossible to reach as well. So, you know, there are some areas that have been very badly affected that we haven't even gotten to yet.
It sounds like the needs are great. I can imagine it would be everything.
Yes. I mean, the most urgent needs right now are, first of all, search and rescue. The Indonesian Red Cross is still conducting those operations. And then medical care for survivors and food, including baby food, shelter, and clean water. And, you know, a lot of the survivors are injured with broken bones, and they really need those kind of medical care that's available on the ground.
I heard a story about some of the aid trucks being just bombarded and looted because people are they're desperate.
Yes, I've seen reports of that. Our specialists and teams are actually going in. We've actually brought in we've brought in ships of relief items because we've had to find creative ways of actually getting these goods and support to the survivors. So we have three ships en route that are sailing to the disaster area. You know, then these ships are carrying water trucks, field kitchens, baby kits, mosquito nets, all these things that people can use, hygiene kits, and including, sadly, body bags as well, and tents for shelter.
Right. I was just going to ask you about shelter, because I've heard that there are still some pretty intense aftershocks happening as well, and people are being told not even to go indoors.
That's right. Most people are staying outside. And so, you know, on top of the terrifying aftershocks, they're staying outside. They're concerned about their loved ones, as you can imagine, families. And because communication is still down in certain areas, people are unable to reach out to their families and are very, very concerned. And that increases the level of stress for the population that's affected.
Sounds like this will not be a fast recovery at all. It just sounds devastating.
No, it won't. And we are, you know, we have launched an appeal for what amounts to about 22 million Swiss francs. So about 20 million US dollars to help and deliver assistance to about 40,000 households And, you know, we're looking at a long-term, complex and challenging response and recovery operation.
That's Laura Nofontaine, Senior Communications Officer with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Thanks for being with us. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will travel to Pyongyang on Sunday to try to further denuclearization talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Pompeo's visit comes ahead of a planned second summit between Kim and President Donald Trump. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert.
We continue to have these conversations, and I think it shows forward progress and momentum that the secretary is making his fourth trip back in less than a year. The first, of course, was as CIA director. This will be his third as Secretary of State. And that shows the president's commitment to the agreement that he and Chairman Kim came to at the Singapore summit.
Nauert told reporters Pompeo will also travel to Japan, South Korea, and China to brief counterparts on the talks. Well, joining us now from Seoul, VOA Korea correspondent Steve Miller. Steve, tell us what's expected at this this weekend.
What we know is that this trip has been scheduled for some time. The exact dates hadn't been announced, but following really that third inter-Korean summit that took place in Pyongyang in September, it was announced that Pompeo would go to North Korea to kind of jumpstart talks for a second summit with President Trump. And this will be his fourth trip there. And his job really is to kind of work out a framework of what will be discussed during that second meeting.
There have been some reports recently, though, that North Korea still has quite a few nuclear arsenals. Where does that fit into all this?
That has been one of the things that moving forward denuclearization talks is going to come up. Going back really even more than a year ago, it's been widely speculated that anywhere between 10 and 100 nuclear weapons were in North Korea's arsenal. Now, this week on Monday, the Unification Ministry here in Seoul said that according to their intelligence, North Korea had anywhere between 20 and 60, so somewhere right in the middle of that. But it's been long been suspected that North Korea had these weapons, and many analysts, as the two nations move forward with denuclearization talks, have said that perhaps a declaration for declaration kind of framework would be what would be needed to move the process along. So one of the things that some analysts are saying that Pompeo may try to secure during the second summit is a complete exhaustive declaration of what North Korea actually has, not in terms of only how many weapons it has, but also a complete list of its testing facilities.
Is it possible that they're willing to now negotiate because they've already got the weapons and they don't need to make more?
Well, some analysts say that North Korea has somewhat of an upper hand in terms of negotiations because the United States has already come to the table once during the Singapore summit. But the position that the United States is in is also a little bit problematic, according to some analysts, because the maximum pressure campaign that the United States is pushing forward with sanctions is running into some resistance from North Korean allies, China and Russia, who recently called during a United Nations Security Council meeting to reevaluate, to look at possibly lifting or easing some of the sanctions because of the warming ties, not only between North and South Korea, but also between the United States. And even South Korea has come out and said that while they support the United States stance that sanctions should remain in place until complete denuclearization, they are requesting Washington perhaps lift or ease or make exemptions for some sanctions to allow for inter-Korean projects to continue that would benefit the North economically.
What about concerns there where you are about the president possibly ending war games altogether? That seemed to be something that was pretty important to that country.
Right. Well, President Moon has said time and time again that any deals that he works out with Kim Jong-un in the North are going to be independent of whatever happens with the U.S.-South Korean relationship in terms of military. Now, some have said that the easing of the exercises here contribute to a confidence-building measure. But also, we also heard most recently that perhaps eliminating the games or delaying some of the larger games may pose a slight degradation to responses from the military here. So they're not entirely concerned about the absence of games. Most South Koreans I've spoken to here, and certainly those in a lot of the think tanks here in Seoul, like the de-escalation along the DMZ and support that. Analysts say that all these measures in terms of scaling back guard posts and creating safety zones and also scaling back the games are easily reversible in case there's a change in tensions.
President Trump recently made some comments that raised some eyebrows here, and I'm wondering how people there felt about it. He said basically that regarding his relationship with Kim Jong-un, that they fell in love. That was sort of an interesting way to describe his relationship with what most in the world perceive as one of the most brutal dictators in the world.
Right. And that particular quote really didn't manifest itself, at least in a lot of the local media that I saw here. But here in South Korea, there has been a real upsurge in the way that they appreciate the lessening of ties and the efforts that the Moon administration has made to North Korea. So there certainly seems to be a swing in the pendulum away from perhaps some of the older, more conservative governments where they took a more hawkish stance.
That's VOA Korea correspondent Steve Miller in Seoul. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Some U.S. Catholic churches are closing as attendance flags. Italy will host a Libya conference in Sicily. A new report finds African countries are struggling to contain terror groups. And a media report alleges President Trump built his fortune via tax fraud. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Lawyers for two women who accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct say they fear the Federal Bureau of Investigation is not conducting a thorough investigation as Republican leaders steer toward a decisive vote on the nomination this week. Attorneys for Christine Blasey Ford, who says she was sexually assaulted by Kavanaugh at a party when they were teenagers, wrote a letter to FBI Director Christopher Wray asking why the agency hasn't contacted their client after she offered to cooperate in the reopened background investigation. An attorney for another accuser, Deborah Ramirez, says he's seen no indication the FBI has reached out to any of the 20 people who Ramirez told them may be able to corroborate her account that Kavanaugh exposed himself to her when they were Yale freshmen. Also Tuesday, comments by President Donald Trump, who nominated Kavanaugh, spotlighted the gulf between Me Too era voters who've rallied against sexual abuse and conservatives who say the nominee is entitled to a presumption of innocence against uncorroborated allegations. And Trump said this shows how vulnerable men are.
Well, I say that it's a very scary time for young men in America when you can be guilty of something that you may not be guilty of. This is a very, very, this is a very difficult time.
The president did say Kavanaugh must be proven not to have lied to the Senate committee.
I don't think you should lie to Congress, and there have been a lot of people over the last year that have lied to Congress, and to me that would not be acceptable.
When Trump ordered the FBI investigation last week under pressure from a handful of Senate Republicans, he set a deadline for this Friday for the probe's completion. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says he wants senators to receive an FBI briefing on its findings at least 24 hours before the chamber takes its first procedural vote. Joining us now to talk more about this ongoing controversy is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Let's first start with the president's comments about young men's vulnerability of false accusations. Is he right?
I think that we're not seeing anything like that happening in America right now. The president has been accused by more than a dozen women, and some prominent Hollywood stars and politicians of both parties have been accused, and that's what we call the Me Too movement. And the Me Too movement is not yet made a target of young men, as far as I'm aware. That said, I think that the president's own administration has done what I consider to be a good thing, which is sending guidance to colleges about the way they are conducting sexual assault trials and sexual assault judicial proceedings on campus. I think the Obama administration went too far and really lost some of the rights of the accused. But what the president is saying today is not about that. His thinking seems to be that Kavanaugh is every man, and if this can happen to Kavanaugh, then it could happen to everyone. And so parents, warn your young men to be careful.
Do you think it also is a statement that he doesn't believe the women that have accused Kavanaugh?
If you're warning the young men about false accusations, you're saying that there's a big threat of women lying, and this all comes out of Kavanaugh. Although, I will say, the president's comments seem to be more open-minded than, say, those of many Senate Republicans. So the president was open to at least the idea that if something comes up, then Kavanaugh will have to remove himself. Whereas if you heard a lot of the Senate Republicans, they just think he should be on the court now and there's no need to do this investigation.
This whole nomination process has been so politically explosive.
You have a large majority of movement conservatives are strongly behind Kavanaugh even today. So what many in the media and maybe many people watching at home saw as conduct unbecoming a judge or a justice, the Senate Republicans are still behind this man.
So now we do have an FBI investigation. It's a very quick one. We don't know how extensive it is. That's in question a bit. In your view, can this be done in this short period of time? Can they get to the bottom of it and have some real answers?
They can get some real answers. They will find out some things, whether they're exculpatory of Kavanaugh or not. We will know more when the FBI gets back to us. Obviously, we would rather have 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or really, maybe we should have given the FBI unlimited time. It's really hard for the Senate Republicans to argue this seat must be filled immediately when they just spent a year delaying Merrick Garland and leaving an empty seat on the court. So this hypocrisy of creating this urgency now is stunning, really.
They are talking about how Democrats are obstructionists, and that's sort of drawing the ire of Democrats who say, obstructionists, you held Obama's nominee and wouldn't even consider it.
Yeah, and I also think if we're talking about judicial temperament, let's talk about Merrick Garland for a moment, because he, like Kavanaugh, has worked hard his whole life and turned down million-dollar jobs over and over again in the hope of getting on the Supreme Court. And he did everything right and waited his turn and then got the golden ticket of a nomination. And then because of politics, and only because of politics, Republicans denied him a hearing. The man did no attacks on the Republicans. The man maintained his judicial composure. He could have gone on TV either during the wait for the nomination or after and shown his bitterness, because you know that man is just as mad as Brett Kavanaugh, but he's a judge and he maintained his composure and his silence. Brett Kavanaugh had to go to that hearing, but Brett Kavanaugh did not have to say things that no judge should ever say. He did not have to behave in a way that no man who wants to be on the Supreme Court should ever behave. And that is what he did. And if you look at how Merrick Garland handled a disappointment as big as what Brett Kavanaugh might have to deal with, these are two very different men, and only one of them belongs on the court if we're talking about judicial temperament.
How do you see this all playing out? Do you think ultimately that this man will get confirmed and become the next Supreme Court justice?
There's several people. We don't know how they're going to vote. I guess if the FBI finds nothing, he gets on the court.
So, okay, what happens if he does make it to the court?
Well, interestingly enough, I don't think this is over if he makes it to the court, because the Democrats are about 80% likely to take the House. Now, they play no role in a judicial confirmation, but the House Judiciary Committee has subpoena power. They can subpoena Mark Judge. They can subpoena all of the accusers. They can do the kind of investigation that the FBI hasn't had the time to do, and they can subpoena Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Now, typically, Congress is reluctant to intrude on the other branches, reluctant to force a justice to testify. But a Democratic majority angered by the process will have no hesitation of putting Brett Kavanaugh through another set of hearings, and who knows what they could find. And I think it will be a very bad day for the Supreme Court and very bad for the separation of powers if that happens. But if Kavanaugh gets on the court and the Democrats take either of the two chambers of Congress, that is exactly what I expect to happen.
And what if he doesn't get on the court?
Then he goes back to the second highest court in the land, the D.C. Court of Appeals, with his friend Merrick Garland, also denied a high court seat. But again, I'm not sure this is over. I think that there will be complaints to bar associations about Kavanaugh's testimony, about lies that he may or may not have told. It's even conceivable that a House Majority Democratic committee could subpoena Kavanaugh just to find out if he's fit to serve on the lower court. That would seem pretty petty, but Washington is a very polarized, petty town right now. I don't think it's impossible that Democrats would do this.
Jeremy Mayer is associate professor in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Well, in 5 weeks, U.S. voters will head to the polls to elect a new Congress, and the outcome will have a profound impact on the next 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. Intensity is building for the November 6th election, especially among opposition Democrats seeking to win back control of the House of Representatives. But the polarizing battle over Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh seems to be mobilizing voters in both political parties, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
President Trump on the campaign trail in West Virginia, whipping up support for his embattled Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh.
I'm not running, but I'm really running. That's why I'm all over the place fighting for great candidates. You see what's going on. You see this horrible, horrible, radical group of Democrats. You see it happening right now.
The confirmation battle intensified even more after last week's riveting testimony by Kavanaugh accuser Christine Blasey Ford and the judge's defiant denial.
Brett's assault on me drastically altered my life for a very long time. I was too afraid and ashamed to tell anyone these details.
This confirmation process has become a national disgrace. You have replaced advice and consent with search and destroy.
Amid the furor over Kavanaugh, Trump is making a furious push around the country to help Republicans hold their narrow majority in the Senate.
Promise me, you got to get out for the midterm. Don't be complacent. You got to get out for the midterm. Got to vote.
But Democrats have some star power of their own, determined to boost turnout, including Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama.
They'll say, well, I'm going to wait until the presidential election. This one is actually more important. This is actually more important than any election that we've seen in a long time.
Trump will be the central figure in next month's election, likely motivating both sides, says John Fortier.
He has been out there endorsing people, working in a way that many thought when he was elected he would not be really within the Republican Party or working with other candidates. He's fully in, for better or worse, and will certainly help some candidates in Republican places, but may turn off people in others.
Democrats have been turning out in big numbers in special elections and in primaries. Positive sign for November, says Jim Kessler.
I expect Democrats to take the House. I now even think they might take the Senate, even though the map is so difficult out there. The excitement among Democratic voters is very, very high. Republican voters are turning out too, but Democratic voters are really turning out.
And we will make America great again. Thank you, West Virginia. Thank you.
Trump is expected to stay busy on the campaign trail right up until Election Day, hoping to blunt a Democratic surge that could severely limit his presidency. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Well, International Edition continues now. U.S. First Lady Melania Trump visited Ghana Tuesday at the start of a tour of Africa, her first major solo international trip since her husband became president. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wita Kuswara has the details.
The First Lady landed in Ghana Tuesday morning and visited the Greater Accra Regional Hospital, where she saw babies being weighed and passed out blankets and teddy bears donated by the White House. Mrs. Trump then went to the Presidential Palace for a private tea with Ghana's First Lady, Rebecca Akufo-Addo. The White House has said her trip, which will also take her to Malawi, Kenya, and Egypt, will focus on maternal and newborn care in hospitals, education for children, the deep culture and history woven into each African country, and how the United States is supporting each country on its journey to self-reliance. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
Well, in fiscal 2015, USAID and the U.S. Department of State provided more than $8 billion in assistance to 47 countries in Africa. USAID programs in Africa were slated for significant cuts in the Trump administration's proposed budget, but have been blocked by Congress. The 2018 Nobel Prize for Physics has been awarded to Arthur Ashkin of the United States, France's Gerard Mourou, Donna Strickland of Canada for their groundbreaking inventions in the field of laser physics. AP correspondent James Hines reports that Donna Strickland and Gerard Mourou will split part of the prize money. They helped develop short and intense laser pulses that have broad industrial and medical applications.
They were able to substantially increase the intensity of shortwave laser pulses, which has turned out to be extremely useful in laser eye surgery, machine cutting precision, and other industrial and health developments.
And as for American Arthur Ashkin,
Ashkin's development was to create something called optical tweezers, which essentially use laser beams to grab extremely small particles such as pieces of DNA and RNA and protein without damaging them to be able to examine their mechanics and other properties.
Strickland was the first woman, by the way, in 55 years to win the Nobel for Physics. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences gave half of the $1 million prize to Ashkin, while the other researchers will share the other half. The remaining two Nobel Prizes for 2018 for chemistry and peace will be announced on Wednesday and Friday, respectively. Los Angeles is hosting an unusual art exhibition for an unusual crowd, dogs. At the show, four-legged art lovers can not only touch some of the art on display, they can sniff it, play with it, and even taste it. For VOA, Angelina Bagdasaryan gives us a look.
For two-year-old Peaches, who is used to spending her afternoons at the beach or in the park, this outing is quite unusual and enlightening. She has never been to an art exhibition before, let alone one made specifically for dogs. All the pieces presented here were created just for Pooches.
I think she loves it. She would love it better if there was more food.
The exhibition called Dogumenta is a curated art show that features a variety of objects that appeal to canines.
Pups, like humans, each have different taste in art. Some pups like work that's more sculptural. Some pups like work that they can maybe take a bite out of. Some pups like work that they can just pose in front of and just, you know, be themselves.
Exhibition curator Jessica Dawson is certain that dogs of any breed can appreciate art. But not all the works here are just for looking at and admiring. Some objects are meant to be sniffed and investigated.
This post below is actually imported from a farm on the East Coast. It was created by pigs. And so the pigs have rubbed up against this wooden beam, and now the artist is actually attempting an interspecies kind of art experiment and communication. It's redolent with pig smell, and so when the pups go up to it, they're actually getting a message from pigs.
And this showpiece grabs the attention of both dogs and humans.
What she's done is actually go into the No-Kill LA shelter and taken paw prints of pups who are looking for homes. She's also met some of the pups who did find homes and took their paw prints and as well those of their new human owners, and she's installed them here on this gate.
Anyone accompanied by a dog can enter the exhibition for free. And though the four-legged art lovers refused to comment on camera,
do you like it?
They all seemed quite happy. Apparently, a dog's life in Los Angeles is not a bad one.
There you go. Good boy.
For Angelina Bogdasarian in Los Angeles, California, I'm Anna Rice, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. Find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.